Hello, welcome back to Seeking Scale. Andy, how's it going?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Yeah, it's like I definitely go through phases of overwhelm and anxiety and everything else, like getting ready for the baby and like trying to juggle everything, but still a good amount to do on the business side, but making progress on the home side, which is a more important side for now and really forever, but feeling better about where things are at right now. So that's at least let me calm down a little bit, but yeah. How are you?
I'm feeling jealous. You're in the treehouse again this week, which is amazing. Like I think we had camera issues last week or whatever, and so I couldn't see it. Though just put a glimpse, and it's totally cool. It's much more cool than my office. So yeah, just like distracted by that a little bit as we're recording.
It's like it's for people. Well, I guess we don't put this on YouTube, so everyone listening. Yeah, it's like the house we got has a nice treehouse in the backyard. It's sort of like a tiny home. And my dream was always to have a tiny home office in the backyard. But I was like, there's no way I would ever spend the money to actually build it. And this house we looked at had like a treehouse in the backyard and with electricity. I was like, oh, okay, this could work. And then,
cool.
Yeah, I think it'll be my 3-season office, maybe 2-season office for a couple of years, but I don't think it'll be mine for too long. So I'm going to enjoy it while I can.
Yeah. Yeah. How was getting Wi-Fi out there? Like, do you have mesh or what's the
deal? Yeah, so I have like mesh. So I set up a bunch of the Eero's just around the house, put one in here, and it's been fine. Sometimes I do have like another, before I set that up, I had set up like a separate USB, like Wi-Fi, kind of like a high, like longer range, like Wi-Fi adapter. And that worked. And I still have that here, but I don't really need it. The Eero's have been good enough. And honestly, I'm like, it's funny. It's like the background, like this tree is like right behind me. Our yard is flat, but then is wooded around it. Like the trees drop down to a brook. And so this is basically level with the yard. But as soon as you get into it, there's like nothing under you, maybe like 40, 50 feet from the house. So it's not like I'm too far either. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
But yeah, it's been good. It's been good.
Nice. Nice. Really hard for everyone listening to follow, I'm sure, but just verbally. But
just trust us, it's cool, guys.
So I thought we'd have like a current events episode, which we don't ever do, but there are a couple things in the world right now. I'm not even going to talk about guns because
yeah, I was going to say that this could go in a lot of directions, but
I just can't. But no, I thought talking about like Profitwell merging / being acquired with Paddle, and then kind of just broader talking about the economy and kind of what we're seeing, what we're hearing, and kind of what's going on in the world. So with the Profitwell thing, was it a merger or an acquisition?
I mean, it's an acquisition, but I'm assuming one is Paddle public.
I don't know. I think they might raise the Series D.
Okay, so I think they might be gearing. They are gearing up for an IPO. But so it was an acquisition as it was framed, but I guess like merger is reasonable. It's just like, I'm sure it's not like a even split. So like from my outsider's perspective, I would assume it's not like they're like gobbling Profitwell up and they expect to just kind of go away and become part of Paddle and lose the brand and all of that. It sounds like, and especially just from reading some of Patrick's tweets, that it's like they kind of want the Profitwell brand to keep going and or at least the team to keep doing what they're doing. And I think Patrick said he's going to do like an AMA where he'll answer literally like anything about the deal. Ben, they don't like publish true metrics, but I remember like last time I talked to him on my podcast years, like 3 years ago, they were doing well over 10 million a year ARR and they've only grown since. And I would have to assume there's some secondary, like some of it's coming off the table. I wouldn't view it as, that's kind of like the questions I would be most interested in hearing is like, it's a bootstrap business. I would assume some of the leadership team has equity, but maybe not. Like, I mean, like Patrick absolutely has a vast, vast majority. And so maybe it's just cut the check to him. I don't know. Or maybe it's like, some of it is left in the coffers. I don't think so. I think it was phrased as an acquisition. Like I think they got paid $200 million and will be able to continue operating. Like Paddle now owns 100% of Profitwell stock, and it was probably a stock deal also though. So like it's not as though it's literal cash. Maybe I wouldn't be surprised if there was some component that's cash. But if they're gearing up for an IPO,
you would want the stock. I would want the stock. It just, I mean,
it, or it's at least it, like,
it doesn't put money in your bank right now, but it's going to be worth
the liquidity
more,
event is close enough. So
yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So I would guess that's probably more likely what it was is
yeah.
a stock deal.
Yeah.
And then liquidity event coming up. And
the headline number is 200 million yeah. is what I saw. Yeah. I think I saw like acquisition/merger. I don't think it's terribly important what you call it. Total comp of 200 million. So some cash, mostly stock probably. And it's great. You know, I think the thing that I think about with this is like one, like Patrick's been doing it for a long time. And I grin a lot with this because they started as a consultancy, right? It was just him. Like he's just a data guy. And started as the Price Intelligently consultancy, and they built a product. And then the revenue has kind of shifted from like 100% consultancy to like some product with like Retain and some of those services to where I understand that like their product revenue is now like 80%+ of the company, even though the Price Intelligently consultancy does very well, I think. But like, I just look at it as like, this is the path, right? Like this is the path. If you don't want to raise money, is start as a consultant or a product as a service or whatever, and then just roll the profit from that into the business. I mean, I'm partial to it because that's what we did, but it just makes so much sense because it gives you a ton of insight into the market and it lets you develop like a name in the space and then just go sell something else to the same customers once you have that product. You know, it's just like, it's so de-risked at that point. You know, and like I think about like Laura Roeder has done this. Like this is, she's on her third or fourth business, like selling the same stuff to the same people, like different stuff to the same people. And it's just amazing. Like I love
think,
it.
I agree. I think you may make it sound a lot easier than it is. I don't think you're saying that like what Patrick and the team did or what Laura and their team did is easy, but it's like a business takes money to grow. The money for Propwell was like, primarily came from consulting, but it was a lot of money. Like they were doing six-figure consulting deals. And so for most of us, that's not really a realm we could get into. It's like to be able to offer like that high dollar of a service where it's like, I mean, he grew quickly and profitably, like it wasn't like I'm sure they had times where they burned, sort of. I would assume like similar to Shikart Hook, where like, yeah, they have times where they burn, but then their goal is like balance it out quickly enough. But so, yeah, the scale that they were able to reach, I just feel like a lot of it is to do with the deep expertise that they had and the ability to sell that and the ability to manage six figure consulting is like that's an entirely different skill. And so I think, yeah, like if you can do that, it is an amazing path to self-fund software company, which takes a huge investment upfront and along the way, and then is much slower to ramp up the profits. And I think what you've done is a more approachable version of that, but it has to be slower because selling the services when they're hundreds of dollars a month is different than tens of thousands a month.
Yeah.
That's the only caveat I would add, but I agree. It's like, if you want to own the vast majority of what you're doing, the money has to come from somewhere. And it can come from you, like working a high paying job and funneling it off into an agency and whatever else to like get the MVP out the door and start getting traction, or it can come from consulting, like selling services. And I think the ideal synergy is the service model, like you're saying, that is very related to the product you're ultimately building. Because like you're saying, you have the expertise, you have the insight, you can do the high touch version. And then from there, scale down to like, all right, like we can't do all these things for every customer, but like, how can we take bits and pieces of this and make it like automated so it's low touch so anyone can come in and just get some of the value? It's like the perfect learning ground because you're getting paid very well for it. And which makes it, one, gives you cash to work with, but also it's worth it for you to put the time in to just like solve the problem. But there's so many things in product development where it's like, well, like I could get on a bunch of these customer interviews, or like, and even then I was like, well, we could solve it this way, but to really solve it, that's going to take way more work. Let's just kind of get this like half step, but I'm going to do some validation, but like, I'm not going to walk across the Sahara Desert to try to figure this out. But like with the, when someone's paying you six figures, you're going to figure it out. And yeah, those insights really help.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I'll just add two more kind of feathers in the cap of this. And it is one, like, this makes bootstrapping or self-funding approachable for non-technical people. That's obviously like how and why I did it, is like, otherwise, if you're a developer, you just code this stuff in nights and weekends. But for a non-developer, you have to build a business to then pay for developers to build a product. And the other one I'm forgetting.
Well, I can jump in with like a quick aside,
yep,
while you think. So it was Vegas a few years ago at a marketing type conference, and it was not MicroConf, but it was talking with a couple of people playing craps late at night, and the subject of like buying Baremetrics came up. One of them was looking into doing that. And I just remember being like, why in the world would you want to compete with Patrick Campbell? Like, he is just super fucking smart and just executes. Like that's the thing, is there's people who have, no, I don't like saying great ideas because it's more than that, like deep strategic thinkers, but that don't actually act on it or are super slow to do that.
Yep.
And it's like Patrick has that strategic mindset, but then like builds a team out, executes, like does it, and then it, yep, keeps going and is always thinking five steps ahead. And I was just like, why would you want to compete with that? And there's like, well, like we don't need to. Like it's not necessarily like winner take all. And that kind of like was like, no. At that point in time, like I just wasn't thinking about that. But it also does show like the different outcomes that those businesses had. Whereas like,
right,
it's like, yeah, like no, like Baremetrics was a great outcome for Josh
or something. Like
Baremetrics was a great outcome for Josh. I think like 3 or 4 million, something like that. And the people that bought it have doubled prices, doubled revenue, pretty much. It's like great outcome for them. But then it's like, yeah, Patrick, yeah, $200 million exit. So it's still showing like, all right, like figure out what game you want to play. And there's multiple ways of winning it, but knowing, yeah, you don't have to compete against everyone in the space, but there are different ways to skin a cat. And I think,
yeah,
Patrick,
yep,
yeah, did that.
Yeah.
Were you able
I don't
to think
remember
about
the other one the other that thing? I was going to say. No, I don't. So we'll just move on to
transition then. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll just move on economy. To talk about the economy. You know, it's interesting, man. Like, obviously, like Y Combinator put out some stuff. Techstars, Jason Lemkin put out some stuff in the last couple of weeks talking about, you know, managing burn rate, raise money now if you are going to need it next 2 years, all this kind of stuff. Within Tiny Seed, there's been discussion on the kind of similar things, even though Tiny Seed companies are much less risky. The typical Tiny Seed company is much less risky in this respect, that they're not like entirely venture backed and have huge burn rates. I'll say from our perspective, I think we're seeing this on the sales side a bit, just in terms of like lead volume. It's tough to tell because we've done some things about like raising prices and changing some of our funnels that could just be a coincidence with this. Not seeing it in terms of like churn numbers or new trial starts or anything like that. But I think certainly like, if you're out there trying to raise money and needing that to be able to stay alive, like that's not an enviable position right now. I don't know. I'll pause there and then I'll give like my prediction of kind of like where this is going, maybe. Like, is there anything else that you like want to say about that?
Yeah. I'm trying to like, not that I'm super filtered, but I'm going to remove it a bit, where there's like this great video, very tongue in cheek, like satire, that I loved in college. And it's like Bert the Broker. It's like a bro Bible YouTube thing. And like one of the lines in it was like, you know, I keep reading the Wall Street Journal. There's this recession going on, but you know, me, my friends, we just choose not to partake in that. And I feel like in the bootstrapping world, we can have that luxury a bit. It depends on who we are selling to. And I think the more you're selling up market to like enterprisey things, they're going to be pulling back, and that has a trickle down effect. You can also feel it if you're on like the very bottom end of things where consumers are tightening up their wallets, but where most of us are swimming, I just don't think it has a major impact. And even for like the venture backed companies, if they are doing like the big enterprise sales, like, yeah, that's different. But for the vast majority of them, like the reason they're worried about this is because they're not going to be able to raise again without a huge down round. It's not as though their business, when you take out discussions like unit economics and everything else, but like their business didn't fundamentally change. What changed is that when they're running a company that is lighting money on fire because they assume they can keep getting more money, when that stops, then it's like, oh shit, like we can't keep doing this. But if they could, they like many of those companies would have continued to grow and been huge companies, but they just can't dial it in. So I guess I just feel like it's not super relevant to me. I mean, we obviously sell to consumers. If it's protracted, yeah, that's not going to be great for us, but I don't think it should be something we feel too strongly. And we're in a fortunate enough position where like, I'm not like near retirement. So I'm not looking at like the brokerage accounts. I'm not looking at the retirement accounts, all that stuff and seeing it. And even if I do, one, the gambling mindset has just helped me just like not, it doesn't hurt that much, but it also doesn't hurt as much because it's like, I don't need that. And so I can understand people who aren't able to divorce themselves from like the emotion of the money as much. And I'm not trying to downplay that, but I think if you just don't pay attention to it and keep doing what you're doing, it shouldn't have a major impact, because it's like so much of this stuff is because things were wildly inflated as far as valuations and everything else goes 4 months ago. So like, I really hate all these like Twitter heads and people on CNBC and everything else just being like, oh, like we got to fire, like the CEO's got to be fired. Their company lost 80% of its value. So yeah, half the fucking stocks in like the SaaS index did too. And like, yeah. why are you assuming that the high watermark for that stock was like a valid price?
Right.
And like, and then that's kind of the thing is I think people put too much value on, they don't think it's irrational when it's going in their favor. And they're like, no, like this is what it's worth. And then when the market corrects and like typically like overcorrects in either direction. And like when it overcorrects, they're like, oh, like the world's over. Like I lost all this money. It's like, yeah, like that's only money on paper because people were nuts and SaaS companies could raise at 100 times ARR.
Yeah.
And yeah. So like, I don't know. That's my mini rant, but it's like, I think we're going to be all right in our neck of the woods. But I also just think people need, it's the same thing of like constantly refreshing your profit well metrics, or in poker, it's like looking at your results in the middle of the session or even every week. It's like, there's so much noise in there. Like don't obsess over those numbers you can't have a direct impact on because they're going to do things like this. And I mean, the stock market's even more of that. You have zero control over it. It's like, what does me checking it every day, every week, every month, like what is that? Like that does absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said. I think that this is like a reversion to like normal valuations for a lot of these companies. And I think like what's happening is like public companies valuations are going down, which is affecting like the venture market, which is affecting startups. And that's getting closer to kind of our world, I think, but not even right. Like we're not raising venture capital and you aren't either. And I think that's really cool because it gives us a lot of optionality and even opportunity, maybe like some of these heavily funded competitors will like go out of business or lay people off and stuff like that. Like I've already heard people saying like, ooh, rates on, you know, freelancers and availability of people and just kind of like attitude of in the hiring market is changing already, which is interesting. And I kind of see this as like people compare this to 2008 and stuff. And I'm like, man, either I'm really stupid or I don't get it. The same thing. Either I'm really stupid or like just totally missing something where like 2008 was due to like subprime lending and all of this kind of stuff, like derivatives, like that's not happening as far as I know, right? Like what's happening is everything was overvalued because there was nowhere else to put your money because interest rates are really low, right? That is kind of unraveling now. Interest rates are getting a little higher. People are, you know, thinking they can put their money in different places. And so like public tech companies or companies in general are losing value.
I think not outside the same. I don't think it's the same at all. It's like outside of tech, I think people who look at their 401k feel it. But even then, it's like if you're investing, if you're in like a target date fund, yeah, it's down, but not crazy. If you're in even like S&P 500, it's down, but not crazy. It's only if you're like purely in tech. Yeah, you got you lost 70-80%. And like, yeah, that's big, but the vast majority of us are not only invested in tech. And most of us, most of our neighbors for sure, and like everyone else around us is not employed by big tech. So I think that's where it's like in this, on Twitter and podcasts, it feels much worse. And I think the average person feels it. I think the average person is more feeling inflation and still having, the average business is still having challenges hiring and everything else. So no, I was 20 during the financial crisis. And it was weird to me because I was like, poker was booming then and you could get amazing deals in Vegas at the hotels. And so that sort of like spoiled me where I was like, oh, we can get this suite for like $150, $200 a night. Awesome. I love Vegas. But looking back on it is more where like I get my knowledge of not like personal experience, but more just reading about and seeing it. It's just like, no, like we're not having mass foreclosures. We're not having everything else. And I would expect housing prices to go down. But this is the other thing. I just like
10%, people, right? Not 50.
I have no idea the percent, but it's like people obsess over the price and forget that people aren't buying these in cash. Or like even if in our market, like a lot of people were, they're not, usually not keeping it in cash. It's going to be, they'll pay cash or no financing contingency, and then they'll get a mortgage afterwards. But there's a difference when you have a mortgage is heavily influenced by the interest rate you're paying. And so for the most part, when you look at the numbers, people are not buying houses they cannot afford, and they're not doing it on adjustable rate mortgages that can reset and make it so that one, they have no equity in the house, they can't make the payment, they just get wiped out. Like these are 30-year fixed mortgages with fixed, very low rates. And so like if rates double, I mean, I think ours was a little under 3%. And I think people now are getting a little over 5%. Like, I don't know, something around that.
Yep.
That makes like that would knock off like our same payment would buy like a couple $100,000 less of a house. And so I don't know. I think people don't really look at the full picture where these aren't independent variables. And it's like, it would hurt to sell and then have to buy something else.
Right.
But at the end of the day, like if we just look at our mortgage payment and what that would buy us at these current interest rates, it's like, okay, I don't think they're going to fall that much. But if they do, whatever, like we intentionally overbought on the house because we knew it was a frothy time. And who knows what's going to happen in 5 years, 10 years in the market. So let's not buy a house we're going to outgrow in 5 or 10 years. Let's buy a house that if we're here for 30, we're happy with that. And so that was sort of our opinion. And I guess it...
Because you and I will probably never see 2.something% interest rates on a mortgage ever again. So it makes more sense to pay more money for a house to lock that opportunity in to me.
Right. And I think in general, my philosophy is just find ways to just not let these swings impact you when you can't control them. And so it's like, if we bought a house we couldn't afford on a mortgage where the interest rate was going to adjust in 3 years, then like that's a different story. You would have to sweat that because like it impacts you. But I don't know. It goes back to kind of bootstrapping, that whole philosophy of like just balancing things versus the venture capital route, which there's merits to both, but it's high risk. And when things work out, you look like a genius. But if they don't, like it all can come crashing down like very quickly. And I guess that's sort of what I view that we're seeing in the tech space now, but not the housing space. I feel like that's sort of what the housing was like in 08. And not to say like I do expect prices to come down, it'd be wild. It's wild to me that they haven't come down more with the rates going up as much as they have, but we'll see.
Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, I think that as opposed to 2008, like we could see this drag on for a while if inflation stays high, probably, just because people have less money to spend on stuff. I'm not enough an economist to say there, but yeah, it's interesting. Like I guess the short version is we hear a lot about it because we're in the tech bubble, but not affecting businesses like ours as much as what we're hearing in like our kind of bubble news, which is nice.
My last hot take will be on the inflation side. Obviously, printing or minting or however like technically it was done trillions of dollars is going to have an impact on things. And it seems like there's like a very, I forget where I heard it, but it's like a very, very like nearly one-to-one correlation between like equity values and the amount of money minted, where it's like it goes to the markets. And so I think that frothiness made sense, but I feel like what people are not thinking about in the just day-to-day inflation is prices hadn't changed in forever. And it's like in our ecosystem, it's like we always hear the beat of the drum of like raise prices. And so I think there were obviously and still are supply chain crunches that force prices to go up. But to me, it almost felt like people was like, oh shit, like these other companies are raising their prices. We are too. And they're like, oh, no one, like people kept buying, like let's raise them again. And it was almost, it was obviously heavily influenced by economic policy. But I think a lot of this was like catch-up inflation, where it's like prices hadn't raised in so long that when people were testing the waters and noticing it wasn't making an impact, they were just like, okay, yeah, we'll raise our prices now. Because so many small business owners are deathly afraid of raising prices, but when they feel like they can point at the boogeyman and blame inflation for it, whether or not that's like actually true, it gives them an out. And when their costs actually do start going up, they have no choice. And then they're like, oh, we could go a little bit higher too. So I wonder,
one thing I don't know, but I'd be curious is like, does deflation happen very often? Or is this just the price we're going to start paying for a pound of bacon, like for the rest of our lives? I would suppose it's more of the latter. Like, I think deflation probably happens, but not nearly as much as inflation has happened, at least in this case. Like, I just don't think, if people can keep charging what they're charging now and will pay, then why would they lower their price?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So we'll see how it all shakes out.
Econ 101 from Craig and Andy, as always.
That might be generous, but yeah. Next week,
right,
we'll be back with more of a traditional episode. We just kind of wanted to mix things up a little bit. There's a lot going on out there that we wanted to dig into. But next week, we'll be back with some updates on the business. But thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And talk to you next week.